Now, there arose a new king over Egypt. He knew nothing about Joseph, but said to his people, "Look, the descendants of Israel have become a people too numerous and powerful for us. Come, let us use wisdom in dealing with them. Otherwise, they'll continue to multiply. And in the event of war, they might ally themselves with our enemies, fight against us, and leave the land altogether." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built for Pharaoh the storage cities of Pitom and Ramses. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more they multiplied and expanded, until the Egyptians came to dread the people of Israel and worked them relentlessly, making their work lives bitter with hard labor, digging clay, making bricks, all kinds of field work. And in all this toil, they were shown no mercy. Moreover, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was called Shiphrah. Birth, he said, "If it's a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her." They didn't do as the king of Egypt ordered, but let the boys live. "You've done this and let the boys live." The midwives answered Pharaoh before the midwife arrives. Therefore, God prospered them, and because the midwives feared God, he made them founders of families.
So the new king who arose over Egypt seems very afraid and not particularly inclined to use his power for good. The people who are unlike him, the foreigners in his land, scare him. And so he afflicts, oppresses, burdens, enslaves them. And when those measures don't achieve his ends, he decides to start killing them outright. When you see the women on the birthstool, if it is a son, kill him. It's chilling. It's bleak. How will they escape the power of the Pharaoh? The rabbis write about the people's slavery like it wasn't just the forced labor. They had to make bricks with their hands, but the slavery infected their souls and their hearts and their minds. It was like their minds were boxed in and locked up. They're paralyzed by a sort of inertia. The rabbis call it the Egyptian disease. And the Egyptian disease is not something confined to the historical past. It's something that's always threatening to keep us from redemption or transformation. It sucks the life, it sucks the imaginative capacities out of people. Even when people are not actually wearing shackles, their minds and their hearts are shackled. The disease can get you anytime. The Israelites are so damaged by the disease that once they get out of Egypt, Moses keeps wondering if they're even fit for redemption, if they're even capable of feeling or being free, or if they're just destined to serve the empire's interest to always be the slaves to power. It comes up over and over again in the story of Exodus. Moses leads the people out of Egypt. They get out of the Pharaoh's grip. They escape. But then they keep questioning whether they should have. They are barely out of Egypt when they start complaining to Moses. "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not what we said to you in Egypt? Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians." They complain that the food in the wilderness is not like the food in Egypt. They long to go back to Egypt and sit by their pots of meat. They don't like the wilderness. It's too wild for them. Like slavery represented some twisted security. It gets aggravating to read these accounts, honestly. I mean, yes, the wilderness can be uncomfortable. But, I mean, can't they stand a little bit of uncomfortableness? They're free. But I guess maybe it's hard to be free. Hard to free your mind from the shackles of the powers that be. I think that the Egyptian disease is pretty widespread. A certain inertia that's hard to overcome. Like, we know there are things that enslave us. We could walk out, but it's like we're stuck. I mean, look at people looking at their cell phones. Maybe you guys read this story about the engineer who created the like button for Facebook. Is taking measures to block himself from using social media altogether, said he didn't mean to create something that was going to damage people's cognitive capacities. Bright dings of pseudo pleasure, so addictive that everyone's looking at their phone all the time. It keeps people from human connection. And maybe you read the story in The Atlantic about the unprecedented rates of depression among teenage girls linked to how much they use social media. People in the tech industry send their children to special schools that don't allow iPhones or iPads or even laptops. The technology is damaging people's IQs. But it is hard to walk away. Fossil fuels, banks, the insurance industry, we pay profiteers who care nothing for us to insure us. My Amish neighbors don't buy insurance from corporations. They cultivate community. I'm just saying, there must be options. Besides capitalism, white supremacy, it may be uncomfortable to step out of Egypt. It's an influential tyranny. Maybe it is a disease, the inertia. There's some movements from time to time, but they don't gain that much momentum. Everything sinks so quickly back into the power system. Power? People get it. People believe in it. Alternatives to power? I mean, it really does take some imaginative capacity. It's the disease of believing this is how it is and this is how it will be. There's no choice. You serve the system in place. I think that uncomfortable is going to be a part of redemption, liberation, the resistance. So the Egyptian disease is evident in the state of the Pharaoh's heart, which the text repeatedly says is hard. A hard heart is one of the symptoms of the disease, this rigidity, an intolerance of vulnerability. Maybe the Pharaoh doesn't exactly choose to be so mean. Maybe he's disease-ridden. The Midrashic accounts actually claim that the totalitarian grip of the powers that be was so tight, it was so suffocating, that no slave ever escaped from Egypt without, I love these stories, no one ever escaped without the help of the midwives. Something new needs to be born? Step aside, gentlemen. Bring in the ladies. book of Exodus starts out recounting the names of the sons of Jacob, the Israelite men, the patriarchs who have all died. And then it abruptly starts naming anyone and just recounts this multiplying of unnamed people. And you could read that multiplying as a good thing, but actually one of the words for the multiplying is not very complimentary. It's a word linked to a reptilian or insect-like reproduction. Less birthing than spawning and swarming. There's a lot of midrashic speculation about that word. Some rabbis say it's an indication that this generation had lost the distinctiveness of being people of God. They were people of empire. They lost their purpose. They became like masses of unindividuated, insect-like conformists whose whole effort was to assimilate to the surrounding empire and whose unconscious drive was for lemming-like compliance. After the 70 original immigrants had died, says Sephorno, a 16th century rabbi, I got all those insect-like words from him. Sephorno says the Israelites inclined toward the ways of reptiles. That seems a little bit harsh to me. But I like it as a setup for what emerges. The first people to be named again among the masses of conformists, not more patriarchs, not David or Jacob or Donald or Larry, not George or Mark or Harry. Shipra and Pua, women who will resist, women who will rise against supremacy, Shipra and Pua. Some rabbis say their names replicate the sounds of women in labor. I'm not really sure if those are the sounds I made, but I like the sentiment. What can redeem these people? Enlarge the possibility, reinvigorate the conformist mind. What can mobilize a contradictory vision to power's totalitarian edicts? Free the people from their service to mortar and bricks? Women. I mean, I'm not making this story up. It's in the Bible. There were women in Genesis, and there will be more women in the Bible, but of course, but mostly after this, the narratives will be male narratives. But at this most critical juncture in the scripture, the Exodus, women drive the events. The bitter hard service in mortar and bricks didn't keep the Israelites from reproducing. So the Pharaoh tells the midwives, he commands them that they have to start killing babies. When they go to a woman in labor, if they see that it's a girl, they can let it live, but if it's a boy, they are supposed to kill it. But the midwives don't do what the king of Egypt commands. They let all the babies live. They disobey the king. They don't follow the king's rules. Of course he isn't happy. He comes back and demands, why have you let the children live? They don't seem to be very afraid of the powerful man. It's like his power doesn't impress them or daunt them. Maybe because they spend their time delivering babies, little powerful in their powerlessness babies. Authority is no match for the life that they see every day. They're intimate with another story. A power that is almost opposite of the power of big, hard, rigid, brick-like power. They usher life into the world. Every day, a new creation. So the midwives tell the Pharaoh that, and this actually seems really pretty funny, they tell him that they can't kill the babies because the Hebrew mothers, unlike the Egyptian women, are so vigorous that they give birth to babies so fast that the midwives can't even get to them in time to kill the babies. I mean, imagine that. midwives running, babies popping. It's a little bit of an outrageous story, but they're not afraid to venture it. The women are so irrepressibly fruitful, they defy the Egyptian edict with their bodies. They create new life. That is, in some sense, the meaning of redemption. Flourishing life. Fruit, trees, flowers, art, songs, poems, creation. It is the counter-narrative to lifelessness. So the midwives tell this story that's probably not entirely true in terms of objective reality, about the babies coming so fast that they can't even get there. The women are too vigorous. Another translation of the Hebrew vigorous is simply, these women are alive. So the midwives' story creates this alternative world to the one that the Pharaoh imposes, where life and birth happens irrepressibly. I love them. It's frustrating. Frustrating might be an understatement. To look back over Christian commentary on this text and see how they have been manhandled. First Augustine, and then a lot of medieval men, Aquinas, Peter Martyr, Gregory, so-and-so, focus their attention on the fact that these midwives lied. And they use the story of the midwives to frame their treatises on lying, to examine whether lying is ever permissible. And they conclude, no, lying is never permissible. The midwives' lies about the women being irrepressibly birth-giving were reprehensible. And surely these lies kept them from the true reward of eternal life. And this fixation on the problem of the lying midwives continues in the Christian Reformation and post-Reformation. Calvin says that surely the midwives were displeasing to God, though God showed them great forbearance and forgave them. I mean, OMG, WTF. I mean, talk about rigidity and lack of imagination. On the other hand, Rashi, a rabbinic commentator from the 11th century, imagines that the women all but disappear from the narratives after this because clearly the women were not like the men who couldn't get free from their enslavement to power. The text never actually specifies that the women complain about the wilderness. So Rashi says they didn't. They never wanted to return to Egypt. They didn't long with the men to go back to slavery. This is not a 20th century feminist reading. It's from a medieval Jewish Frenchman. Rashi says, in that generation, women would repair what men tore down. I guess I like the way he reads. Obviously, all male narratives are not the same, and it's finally starting to sink in that what have been considered masculine and feminine characteristics are not traits that are biologically determined. Some men relate to what have been called feminine traits. Some women relate to what have been called masculine traits. But there are human ways of being that much of culture has defined as masculine that have been privileged over other ways of being. And I think we can see now that this hasn't been good for the world. A sort of militant masculinity that proves itself through violence, for example, that ridicules gentleness and encourages callous displays of power, It thrives on hardened divides and postures of certainty. It launches the mother of all bombs and gets applauded for it. We need to change that narrative. We need to stop privileging that way of being if we want life on this planet to continue. The church, when it's being the church, and it's at its best when it's not serving the interests of empire, the church is all about the alternative narrative. The Christian story is about a God that gives up power for love. It's astonishing to me, over and over again, a God that gives up power for love. This is an alternative narrative. God doesn't demand subservience, but God gives God's self to us, gives us love so that we can have life abundantly. Every week we come here and we have the opportunity to participate in this meal. And I think that taking it and eating it might actually help cure the Egyptian disease. Because I look out at you, I look at this community, and there is so much life. You are free. No shackles. Imagine the possibilities.